WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actor and director Dennis Hopper is best known for such films as Easy Rider, Apocalypse Now, and Blue Velvet. He's also an artist, photographer, and art collector. An exhibit of his photographs from the 1960s is on view through mid-September at the Max Center for Art and Architecture in Los Angeles. On this archive edition, we have a 1996 interview with Hopper in which we talked about his involvement with the visual arts and how that relates to making movies. We talked first about growing up in a small town in Kansas.
I just remember it was a dry state, but if you're old enough to get your hand up on a bar, they'd put a drink in it. So,
you know,
and fighting around the drive-ins seemed to be, and not the drive-in movies, but the drive-in hamburger joints seemed to be the big thing to do after football games. And my mother managed a swimming pool in Dodge City, Kansas, so I had an active swimming life as a child. And my grandfather's a wheat farmer. So it was a good life.
Was it fun to see movies about Dodge City living there?
Well, I remember Errol Flynn came to Dodge City when I was about 5 years old. That was a big time for the premiere of, I think it was called Dodge City. I think for Fort Dodge or whatever it was. It was a movie that Errol Flynn starred in with Olivia de Havilland. And anyway, they came there. That probably had a lot to do with me eventually wanting to be an actor, I think.
Was that the only connection you saw between the movie world and your own life?
Well, I mean, I was raised at the end of the Dust Bowl, so I used to tell people the first light that I really saw was not from the sun, but it was from a movie projector. You know, my grandmother used to, she didn't drive a car, so she used to fill her apron. We lived about 5 miles outside of Dodge, and so my grandfather would go off to the farm in Garden City, which is 60 miles away. My grandmother would fill her eggs full of apron on Saturday mornings.
Fill her apron full of eggs?
Yeah, and we'd walk into town. She'd sell the eggs at the poultry place and get the money. We'd go to see a matinee. And I'd see the Singing Cowboys. Once in a while, we'd see an Errol Flynn movie or a sword-buckling movie. That's about it. I don't really remember what they were, but I knew I wanted to know where they were making these movies. And Kansas was a very flat place, so I wanted to know where the trains were going and what a mountain looked like, what a skyscraper looked like, what the ocean looked like. And years later, I thought that I think it's one of the reasons I became so interested in the visual aspects of things, because that horizon line, when I finally saw the ocean when I was 13 years old, I saw my first mountain when I came to Colorado when I was 13 on the way to California. I was really disappointed. My mountains that I'd imagined were so much bigger. And I got to California and I saw the ocean. It was the same horizon line that I'd seen on the wheat field. And I thought, wow, this is not what I'd imagined, you know. I don't know what I thought. I thought you could see all the way to China or something, or it'd look different. It'd be a different angle. But it was the same horizon line. And I think that then I saw my first skyscraper, not as big as I'd imagined. I always thought that, like, my imagination had been developed quite was a little out of whack, you know. My buildings were bigger, my mountains were bigger, and the ocean was bigger in my imagination than in reality. So,
well, when you started taking photographs, did you want the size of buildings and the size of mountains to be as big as they had been in your memory from movies, or did you want them to be as real as reality was, even though that was often disappointing?
Yeah, well, you know, what I did was I became an actor when I was 18 years. I started acting at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego when I was 13, and doing Shakespeare and doing all that. So when I was 18 years old, I moved from I moved from San Diego to Los Angeles, and in a short amount of time, I got a contract at Warner Brothers. I was still 18 years old. I just graduated from high school, and I was now under contract to Warner Brothers, and I was doing Rebel Without a Cause. And when I was 19, I did Giant with Rock Hudson, Elizabeth Taylor, and James Dean. So during that period of time, everybody was photographing me. So when I started taking photographs, which was in this period of time, I'd already been a painter. And I started taking photographs, not of people, but of walls and of things where I had no depth of field. I would shoot flat on, so I had a painting surface. So I'd shoot flat on a wall or flat on something, and it would become like the surface of a painting. So that was my early beginnings of photography in the early 50s. And then I went through a Cartier-Bresson decisive moment period when I when I came to study with Lee Strasberg in New York, which is where you catch something in action. Guy's throwing a ball, it's just before he catches the ball, or somebody's walking over a puddle, which is a famous thing. He's got his foot up just before his foot hits the water, or whatever. It's a moment where you see with a still camera when to push the shutter.
What were a couple of the decisive moments that you clicked the shutter for?
Oh, dear. Well, I mean, through the time of my career of taking photographs, I was at a lot of different places. I was at the free speech movement in Berkeley. I was at the hippie love-ins. I marched with Martin Luther King through the South. I was a student. I was in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I was at the March on Washington and Selma to Montgomery and all those things. So I covered, and in that decisive moment period, I covered everything from attack dogs and, you know, biting us to a flower being handed to Martin Luther King, you know, by a young girl.
Now, what was your first exposure to art? Was there any art around when you were growing up? And I'd even be interested in hearing if your parents or grandparents had, you know, tacky, kitschy things that they decorated the house with.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I drew when I was a kid, and I studied at the Nelson Art Gallery on weekends. They had an underprivileged children's art class.
Were you an underprivileged child?
Well, I got in there. Yeah, I was. I slipped in. So at that time, I was in a drawing class, and I was doing a little watercolor like I'd learned in Dodge City. And this man came up to me, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm painting this rock and river and so on. And he said, well, son, he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but someday you're going to have to get tight and paint loose. Yeah. And this man was, I'm trying to think of his name, kind of just slipped his name right out, but he was Jackson Pollock's teacher. He was, this is going to drive me crazy. Thomas Hart Benton. Thomas Hart Benton, yeah. He taught me, taught Pollock. Anyway, I studied there, and I found that I would go into the theater and draw the actors.
The movie theater or stage theater?
Stage theater, mm-hmm. Where they were rehearsing plays, and I'd sketch the actors, and So that was sort of my beginning of my art career. And when I arrived in Los Angeles, I had worked at La Jolla Playhouse, and my friend who was my boss there, he was an interior designer, and he was working with Mary Price, Vincent Price's wife, who was an interior designer. They had a kiln where they did tile work at Vincent's house, and I went up there and made some tiles. And that's where I saw, Vincent was an art collector, and that's where I saw my first friends, Klein, my first Jackson Pollocks, my first de Koonings, and so on. We're at his house. And I'd been painting abstractly, but I'd never really thought that anybody really painted abstractly until I saw these things.
Now, it must have been interesting to be exposed to your first abstract art through somebody's private collection as opposed to through a museum.
Yeah.
Did that, in a way encourage you to later become a collector? I mean, because it was part of how you were first exposed to it. I know you collect a lot of art.
Yeah. Well, Vincent gave me a painting, actually, when I was about, I was 19 or 20. Vincent gave me a small painting. I don't even remember who it was by now. Mm-hmm. And I said, I know that you're probably going to be a collector, so let me start you off.
Gee, how nice.
And then when I got my first money, I did start collecting art. And it's like a compulsion. I was thinking about the other day, I think that, you know, I don't have a formula where I go to the right dealer and buy the right painting. I've been very fortunate to seem to have an eye. I bought Andy Warhol's first soup can painting, hand-painted for $70.
When was it? Is it...
That was like 1963, I believe.
Why did you want it? What spoke to you about the painting? What did it...
The first time America had an art form of its own was abstract expressionism. We'd always imitated the Europeans before that, and rather than drawing a mountain and saying, I'm now going to draw a mountain, or I'm going to draw a tree, or I'm going to draw this wonderful face of this person, abstract expressionist says, we're going to use paint as paint. We're not going to draw anything. We're going to make a brush stroke, and that's going to be the painting. And it's going to be action. It's going to be done with action. So we're not going to have time to think and preconceive a lot of stuff. We're just going to use our motion and use the action of painting itself and make that become the design and the pattern and the motion of the canvas. And so this changed the whole way that everybody looked at art. Now, at that time, there was a group of painters in San Francisco called the Bay Area Figurative Painters, and there was David Parks and Elmer Bischoff and Richard Diebenkorn and Nathan Oliveira, whatever. And they were using abstract expressionist terms, and they were going back and using the figure. And I looked at this, and I said, no, this is good painting, but this has already been done. So Tien had done this before in France, before abstract expressionism. This couldn't be the return to reality, because they're using old forms to return to reality. It doesn't make sense to me. So when I saw my first soup can painting, and I saw my first by Andy Warhol, and I saw my first cartoon paintings by Roy Lichtenstein, and I saw the billboard paintings of Rosenquist, and I saw Oldenburg's giant hamburgers and so on, I realized that this was the return to reality, that this was the comic book and the soup can and the Coca-Cola bottle of Jasper Johns and so on, Rauschenberg, and these guys were coming back to reality with a whole new set of things. I mean, before pop art, as we know it, popular art, commercial art, came into being, the largest lithograph was just a 2-foot by 3-foot piece of paper. Then suddenly we could use, there was Rosenquist, and suddenly we could do what commercial art could do. We can make lithographs the size of billboards, and Ed Keenhall showed us that we could take things off the wall and we could make rooms and environment, and Rosenquist took the square and the rectangle and broke the surface for the first time in 1961, and suddenly we had different shaped canvases, and suddenly there was hard edge, and it went on and on, and it was a wonderful, wonderful life I've had in art, because I've seen so many different things happen and develop.
My guest is Dennis Hopper. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition, we're listening to a 1996 interview with Dennis Hopper. There's an exhibit of his photos from the 60s in Los Angeles. Early in Hopper's acting career, he was doing TV, but also living another life, helping Andy Warhol make his first films.
I did his first film with him called Tarzan and Jane Revisited, which he shot out in Los Angeles. Andy had his first shows in Los Angeles. And Roy Lichtenstein, they didn't have them in New York. They were shown at the Ferris Gallery in Los Angeles.
Huh.
And a lot of this was because Marcel Duchamp had the only retrospective he had in his life was in California in 1963 at the Pasadena Museum. A friend of mine, Walter Hopps, gave him a retrospective there. So it brought all the artists out from New York and around the world to Los Angeles suddenly.
No, Marcel Duchamp, I mean, did you read his diaries, his journals?
No, I never did, but I knew him.
You knew Marcel Duchamp?
Yeah.
How'd you meet him?
Well, I met him at his retrospective.
At the retrospective?
Yeah, all of us sort of did.
You didn't play chess with him, did you?
Actually, I did. Yeah,
you did?
Yeah. Not for very long.
So he was
really good.
What was it like to play chess with Marcel Duchamp? I mean, there's like, John Cage has talked about that too, about how he loved to play chess with Duchamp. That was a big thing for Duchamp.
Well, I sat down at a table with him for about 3 minutes. It was a thrill, okay?
Right,
but
right,
I don't know
right.
what moves I made or what he
right,
did, you know, except
right.
that I was thrilled by it. And that was the same day he was playing. There's a famous photograph of him sitting with playing chess with a nude, and that was in Pasadena.
Now, Dennis Hopper, can I talk with you about music a little bit? Has music
sure.
played an important part in your life? Do you like music a lot, listen a lot?
Oh, yeah.
You grew up in your early years before rock and roll. What did you listen to before rock and roll?
Marie, the dawn is breaking. Marie, my heart is aching. you know, something like that.
So this is the era of the Four Freshmen. Who am I thinking of? The Four Aces. The Four Aces.
Right, exactly.
Harry Como, Patti Page. Could you tell the good from the bad then? I mean, was there a difference to you between, say, you know, Patti Page and Ella Fitzgerald?
It's a big, wide, wonderful world. Really? Yeah. No, I could. I didn't know. Listen, I was having enough problems just trying to get through high school.
Was there anything you loved out of all that period of pre-rock and roll pop?
Well, I was a big... When I got to Los Angeles when I was 18, this is like 1954, I got into jazz right away.
Uh-huh.
So there was a period of there before rock and roll. I'm not sure of the years, but there was a period of time there where jazz was king, and Miles Davis was the greatest act in the country, and... Bob Rafelson said to me once, who was the curator, the creator of the Monkees, and later went on to do Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson and so on, and make some wonderful films. But at the time, he said, if Miles Davis hadn't turned his back on the audience, the Beatles would never have been able to invade this country so easily. But Miles would only blow at a certain point when he felt like it. And so he would go out and just stand there and not maybe go through a whole concert. I've seen him go through whole concerts where he didn't blow at all and did make some fans angry. But I still love jazz. And rock and roll was something that I listened to secretly on the radio. I had a channel. I would move it to the rock and roll station. But even my wife, when she got in, I would change it to classical or change it to popular or change it to something. I didn't want anybody to know that I was listening to rock and roll.
Man. Why
it was
not?
Like animal music. You're not supposed to be listening to it. And this was a condition that went on for some time. And by one time my wife got in the car and started the car before I changed the station. It was playing rock and roll. I said, oh, I love rock and roll. I said, you do? Yeah. Big surprise, huh? Oh, wow.
You might be one of the few adults who had to hide rock and roll.
Yeah, well, it was strange, you know. It was a strange time. It's like, it's easy to accept pop art, and it's easy to accept abstract expressionist art most places these days. But in the old days, if you had an abstract painting, that was really weird. And if you had a soup can or a cartoon hanging in your house, I mean, who were you? What kind of weird person were you? And listening to rock and roll was like listening to the jungle or something. I mean, it just was unheard of. I mean, it was not accepted.
Now television, as we mentioned, you were doing a lot of episodic television in the, late 50s,
mm-hmm.
early
mm-hmm.
60s.
Yeah.
When did television come into your life? Not as an actor, but as a viewer.
Oh, as a viewer. I saw my first television show when I was 13.
That's pretty old.
Same year as I saw The Mountains. Yeah, well, I was like, you see, I was, how old was I? What year would it have been? 40.
All right.
Be about 1949, something
yeah.
like that.
What about the best shows to do when you were acting in episodic television? I saw you in the pilot of The Rifleman. You know, they were maybe they still are rerunning it on the Family Channel.
Wow.
It's a really great series. And the episode you're in, you're like the kind of kid gunslinger who comes into town. And
you know,
you're a real show-off in it.
Sam Peckinpah wrote the pilot for...
Yeah, well, he wrote and directed a lot of them.
Yeah. He didn't direct it, but he wrote it. But he was there on the set telling me how to play the part. So, but Sam and I had known each other for years. He was the only guy I knew that smoked grass besides me.
Huh.
So we could hide together on the studio lots and smoke a joint every once in a while.
Just one question about marijuana and other drugs. Do you think that they affected your visual sensibility at all, or you know your artistic interests?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm in these 12-step programs because I had a problem. You know, I became a drug addict and alcoholic, so I'm sort of torn with this question. I think that I don't think anyone needs them to enhance their visual or intellectual capacities. Does it help? It might in the beginning open up some doors, you know, but those doors rapidly close if you're a drug addict. And it's not a way of seeing. It's a way of dying, and that's a reality. As far as drinking, I mean, being an alcoholic and a drug addict, it was so easy for me to point that, because I'm an artist, after all, it's okay for me to drink and take drugs because I have an excuse, and being in total denial about the fact that you're an alcoholic and drug addict, because after all, Van Gogh spent a whole summer of drinking to find that yellow. And then at the end of it, I say, well, yeah, he probably couldn't find the tube the yellow was in. He was so drunk. Yeah. But you justify all these things, and it's too easy to justify using drugs and drinking because you're an artist. And I can't cop to that excuse. I can say, yes, in the beginning, everything works. Sex works, drugs works, everything works. If you go too far with it, it becomes less effective, and then you start working for it rather than it working for you.
Right.
And some of the greatest artists of all time never drank and never took drugs, and that's a reality as much as it is a reality that there, a lot of them did, and a lot of them died painfully stupid lives, which they could have been avoided if they hadn't drank and taken drugs.
Yeah. I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's always a pleasure. It's great listening to your show.
Dennis Hopper recorded in 1996. His photographs from the 60s are on exhibit through mid-September at the Mack Center for Art and Architecture in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.